The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The previous UN climate report was 8 years ago. Maybe the most concerning headline of today's report:
by the time of the next report, it's too late.
Also on the show, the Canadian border finally reopened for people heading north. Americans were ready.
We actually met quite a number of people on the road on the U.S. side of the border who were planning on crossing at 12:01 a.m.
But Canadians, they can still only fly south to see loved ones.
How is that safer than him getting in his car and making a 45-minute trip by himself as a fully vaccinated Canadian? I don't understand.
We'll try to make sense of it. And one of the greatest soccer players of all time is getting a new jersey. Fans in Barcelona are mourning what they're losing in Lionel Messi.
The guy can accelerate from, 1 to 25 miles an hour faster than a greyhound. It's just amazing.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. In Greece, dozens of wildfires are still burning out of control. For a full week now, firefighting crews and local residents have been battling the forest blazes on Evia, Greece's second largest island. The international community is responding to the situation. Greece is getting assistance from France, Germany, Israel, Turkey, the U.S., and others. But thousands of residents and tourists have had to evacuate. Meanwhile, many locals have decided that the only thing they need to be doing right now is helping any way they can. The World's Lydia Manalidou has our report from Athens.
On Sunday morning, volunteers gather at a small warehouse in downtown Athens. They're sorting through donations, bags of rice and pasta, bottles of water, as people trickle in to drop off more supplies. Right outside on the sidewalk, some volunteers are cooking a big pot of lentil soup and bagging up other freshly made food. Nasia Gabesi owns a car and she's here to deliver supplies to the Athens suburbs where fires destroyed dozens of homes and businesses. Most of the wildfires around the capital are contained for now, but in other parts of the country that's not the case. The situation is changing minute by minute, and volunteers are on their phones, frantically trying to figure out what's needed and where.
We saw different posts on Instagram. Many people want our help, and we help with everything we have.
20-year-old Nikolas Nikolaidis owns a moving company, and he's here with his van. People are loading it up with meals, pet food, clothes, and other stuff. Nikolaidis will drive more than 3 hours, about 110 miles, to the northern tip of Evia. It's an island that's accessible by car, and it's where fires have been the biggest and most destructive. Nikolaidis has family members from there who had to evacuate.
Many people lost their houses, lost their homes, lost their cars. Their animals, everything. The videos we see are heartbreaking.
On Greek TV and social media, a constant stream of videos shows forests, villages, and towns in Evia being devoured by flames as locals plead for help. We're burning. Everything's burning, one man yells from his village on the island. This was last week when the fires first broke out there. We need helicopters. Where are they? Why aren't they dropping water from above? He asks. Greek authorities have since said the wind and smoke make aerial firefighting efforts too dangerous at times. And even with international help, crews here have been stretched thin, battling wildfires across the country. But locals say they feel abandoned, so they're doing what they can. Sometimes alongside firefighters, sometimes on their own, battling blazes with garden hoses, buckets, and whatever else they have. Over the weekend, scenes from Evia showed flames tearing through pine forests and olive groves, reaching dozens of villages. This is a woman calling in live to a news program as flames surrounded her town, where evacuees from other areas had been taking shelter. The woman begs the news anchors and anyone listening to send help. By Sunday, the evacuation of Evia was in full swing. People in their cars rushed to the nearby port, where lines to get on ferries stretch for miles. At first, the ferry companies were making people buy tickets to get on board, but that sparked outrage and reportedly an intervention from the Greek government. Eventually, people were allowed to get on ferries for free. The Coast Guard also assisted with evacuations.
Αντιμετωπίζουμε στην πατρίδα μας μια εξαιρετικά κρίσιμη κατάσταση.
Amid mounting anger, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says there will be a time for criticism.
Η προτεραιότητά μας είναι πάντα η προστασία της ανθρώπινης ζωής.
But he says for now the priority is saving human lives. There's been one fatality so far, a volunteer firefighter in the Athens area. The government is also urging people to follow evacuation orders. Many are choosing to stay behind, though, and take a risk to save their homes and livelihoods. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens.
The Taliban onslaught continues in Afghanistan. The militants captured another provincial capital today that now makes 6 under their control since the U.S. withdrawal began in May. So why does the Afghan military seem unable to stop the advances? Retired U.S. Army Colonel Christopher Kalenda served in Afghanistan and as a high-level advisor to the Department of Defense. Chris, when you see this happening after 20 years of struggle to prop up the Afghan government and its military, what is your reaction?
Well, my emotions, how I feel about it, are a combination of frustration, embarrassment, and anger. I spent a lot of time on the ground in Afghanistan. 6 of my soldiers were killed in action, fighting against the Taliban and other insurgent groups. Scores of my soldiers were wounded. You know, a lot of us spent a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, so to speak, in Afghanistan. We poured our heart and soul into this effort, and to see the Taliban gain so much territory and the Afghan security forces not be able to rally is frustrating.
During your years of service, Chris, what were your concerns that this scenario would play out if the U.S. ever left Afghanistan?
Well, the Afghan government had to do one thing to be successful, and that's earn the trust of the people, earn the buy-in from the people. And they haven't been able to do that. And as a result, what you're seeing are Afghans who are supporting the Taliban. The Afghan government, in fact, not only didn't earn the trust of enough of its people to prevent an insurgency, but because they engaged in predatory and kleptocratic behavior, they actually turned a number of Afghans away from them and into the arms of the Taliban.
Apparently, the Afghan forces are having some successes stopping the Taliban. Residents of Lashkar Gah, for example, still had to flee Taliban advances, but apparently significant casualties were incurred on the Taliban side there. Still, 6 provisional capitals under Taliban control. Why do you think Afghan forces are having these difficulties subduing the enemy? What's at the heart of this failure?
You've got leaders within the Afghan security forces that their soldiers just simply don't want to fight for. Soldiers don't believe in them. Unfortunately, prices in the Afghan security forces in many positions have gone for sale. The expectation is that they can use the position to make the money back. And so that this undermines their leadership.
So the training and supporting of the Afghan military that was supposed to hold the country after 2 decades by the U.S., were those efforts just inadequate? I mean, what went wrong?
Well, part of it is the leadership and the corruption problem. Big problem number 2 is that they've got a strategy that simply does not work. Unfortunately, through much of the conflict, the U.S. military officers would write the Afghan security force strategy, and then it would be translated into Dari and Pashto. Afghans needed to develop their own strategy. You know, this idea that we would develop it for them and then translate it into their language just meant that they had no buy-in and no ownership. Yeah, it was primarily that problem where the Afghan security force just didn't have the buy-in, didn't get the repetitions of developing a strategy and trying it, adapting, being innovative. None of those things happened.
So how do you see this playing out? Will the Afghan government be able to hold on? And if they can't, what happens next?
I think you've got three broad scenarios for how this plays out. The first one, and the most favorable one, is the Afghan government and security forces sideline these toxic leaders, rally, and fight the Taliban to a stalemate. And if they can do that, then you're going to get serious peace talks. Scenario number two is that the Afghan security forces collapse and the Taliban has a takeover, and they manage to get the indiscipline problems under control, so that takeover is successful. The scenario that concerns me the most is this third one, in which the Afghan government security forces, you know, sort of fracture, continue fracturing. And then the Taliban experiences catastrophic growth, and they're on the cusp of this right now, where they grow beyond their ability to manage it, and they begin to fragment from within due to internal. You're seeing some of the indiscipline that's a leading indicator of catastrophic growth. Now, if this happens, you get the government and the Taliban both imploding, then what you're going to have are the rise of these sort of warring fiefdoms. And if you get a warring fiefdoms scenario in Afghanistan, then this could be worse than the 1990s civil war.
Personally, for you, Chris, I mean, as someone who has invested a lot of time and energy in Afghanistan, is the country a U.S. concern for a while?
I remember talking with Haji Ibrahim in 2010 and just looking into his eyes and you see the frustration and the sadness of Afghans have been at war for now for over 40 years. And at the same time, you see the disappointment in all of the things that have tried and not worked. And then the hope. I saw all of this in his eyes at once. He's one of the people that, you know, when I wanted to stay involved in Afghanistan, it's relationships with people like him and many, many others that said, you know what, this is worth fighting for. You know, we need to have this partnership for a long time. And it frustrates me that the United States just missed so many opportunities, and the Afghan government missed so many opportunities to bring this war to a successful conclusion. And now here we are with the Taliban taking six capitals in the last few days and poised to take a few more.
Retired Army Colonel Chris Kalenda is the author of Zero Sum Victory, What We're Getting Wrong About War. He's the first American to have fought the Taliban as a commander in combat and engaged them in peace talks. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The World's Shirin Jafari was just in Afghanistan. Last week you heard her report from the western province of Herat and the voices of Afghan women who fear for their future. Find Shirin's reporting and the rest of our Afghanistan coverage at theworld.org. A possible Banksy sighting today. One never knows where the mystery artist's work will pop up next. This time it appears there's a Banksy on Britain's east coast in the town of Great Yarmouth. They've got a tourist attraction there showing life back in medieval times. A village with cottages, there's a small castle, and a stable with a thatched roof about the size of a shoebox. That last tiny scale structure arrived today, says the owner of the attraction. It's got Banksy's name spray-painted in red across the front. If it is the work of Banksy, he's been busy. Other Banksy-like artwork appeared nearby. Over a bus shelter, a spray-painted mural of an elderly couple dancing next to a broken bit of sidewalk, a child shoveling up sand. And on the side of a bridge, three boys playing in a rowboat with the caption, "We're all in the same boat," painted above. Authentication will not be official until photos appear on Banksy's Instagram account. So far, no word from Banksy. Or is it Mr. Banksy? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Army rulers in Myanmar have a tight grip on the country's supply of steel oxygen tanks. As we know, for people with severe cases of COVID-19, oxygen is a matter of life or death. And right now, Myanmar is getting hit hard by COVID. The World's Patrick Gwynn reports that oxygen tanks are being hoarded by the military, while sick citizens struggle to breathe.
$1,000. In Myanmar, that's the going rate for a chest-high cylinder of oxygen on the black market. And for many, $1,000 is like half a year's income. And still, people with dying relatives are willing to pay even higher amounts.
If you get that amount, then you are the lucky person.
Khin Sandar lives in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city, a city that is collapsing under army rule. The generals can barely keep the electricity going. Shops are closed. Food is getting harder to come by. On top of that, by some estimates, half of Myanmar's population is expected to get COVID-19. The word on everyone's lips is oxygen. COVID depletes oxygen levels in the body, and people with bad infections often need it to survive. But oxygen is scarce in Myanmar, so people are dying in large numbers. Even those who have dodged COVID, when they look on Facebook, all they see is grief.
Whenever I use social media, it's like a funeral advertisement. You know, my friends and their family, they are dying every day.
Khin Sandar helps run a general strike committee. Students, bureaucrats, truckers, shopkeepers, all refusing to work until the military backs down. Some of the more diehard strikers are actually doctors and nurses, and they are now running illegal oxygen clinics against the orders of the military junta.
They have to be very careful. If military junta found out that they are doing that, then they can be arrested.
It sounds surreal. Doctors getting arrested for giving patients oxygen, or oxygen sold on the black market like drugs. But this is the fallout from new army rules. They say citizens cannot possess oxygen without special permission. That's not always easy to get from a paranoid military government. Soldiers will even show up to oxygen factories where people wait outside in the searing heat. Khin Sandar says troops will tell everyone, okay, hand over your phones.
Mostly they check social media accounts. If they found out people are against them, then they can be arrested.
Soldiers have also taken over privately owned oxygen factories. The little that is imported from other countries, they can seize that too. As for those underground clinics, in a few cases, troops have pretended to be patients, then stormed in and arrested the doctors. With fewer doctors and the oxygen shortage, the COVID death rate in Myanmar is the highest in Southeast Asia. That's video from a crematorium in Yangon. It looks overwhelmed. Bodies on the tile floor, people in biohazard suits clamoring to keep up. Some families even have to keep their loved ones' bodies at home for days. Meanwhile, military leader General Min Online has said, quote, "Actually, we have plenty of oxygen. All this talk of a shortage," the general said, "is just a rumor created by oxygen dealers to drive up the price." Here's what Khin Sandar, the strike organizer, says about that.
Who will believe that? For sure, no one believes that. Maybe it's enough oxygen for them, not for the public.
The best way to get oxygen for a sick relative in Myanmar is to already be a military officer. Seems everyone else is mostly on their own. But this strategy, treating oxygen like contraband, criminalizing COVID treatment, it could be risky for the military. Because it doesn't just harm a small circle of dissidents. Anyone could potentially watch a loved one die a preventable death, leaving them enraged at the army.
That's like crazy, you know, like sometimes I thought, do they have brains?
What the army does have is guns. Several weeks ago in Yangon, it actually fired rifles over the heads of people lined up for oxygen. They had to be dispersed, an official said, because gathering outside during a pandemic, well, that just wouldn't be safe. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
For those of you who don't follow soccer, listen up because we are sitting atop a historic moment in sports. Argentine Lionel Messi and the end of his two-decade run with his team in Barcelona. Remember when Michael Jordan left the Chicago Bulls still on top of his game? It's probably bigger than that. Messi spoke to the press yesterday.
Es muy difícil esto para mí después de tantos años.
With tears in his eyes, Messi said, "This is very difficult for me after so many years to have lived my whole life here. I am not ready." Reporter Jerry Haddon has been following FC Barcelona for a long time. He joins us now not far from Barcelona where he's on vacation, but for this, he had to talk to us. First of all, Jerry, why is Messi leaving Barcelona FC?
In a nutshell, the club couldn't meet his salary demands. The guy earns roughly in dollars about $80 million a year, and the club happens to have spent a lot of money over the last several years on a whole stable of great players. And they got to the point where they just couldn't not only meet the $80 million, but they asked him if he would take a 50% salary cut. He agreed to that. You know, we all thought he was signing. My son texted me and said, "Dad, Messi's staying another year." And then the next day, suddenly things fell apart. And it was because they've just spent too much. They couldn't even meet his offer to take half the money. He said, I tried to do everything I could, short of saying I'll play for free.
Yeah.
So he's moving on.
So tell us about Messi's long run with FC Barcelona. I mean, I think of Michael Jordan joining the Bulls as a skinny kid right out of college. Messi's been with Barcelona since he was 13. How would you describe him as a player?
Yeah, 13. He started playing in club games at 16. I actually think of Larry Bird more than I think of Jordan, in the sense that, remember, when Bird had the ball, when he let go of the ball, it would either score 2 or maybe 3 points for the Celtics, or he would just make the most unpredictable, incredible pass to somebody else who would then send the ball home. Messi was the same kind of player. He still is. He makes goals that you just can't believe, or he drops the ball off to somebody else who finishes the play. Amazing to watch. Unpredictable, so talented. He's tough. He's small. He keeps running. He gets up, and he's just been, you know, an inspirational. We've lived here almost exactly the same amount of time that Messi has, and we've watched his career. We've watched him win probably all 34 of his titles with Barca, most of his 750-something goals. You know, everyone's so sad that he's leaving.
So since you're not far from Barcelona, in the orbit of Barcelona FC, how are people reacting to his departure there in Spain?
Most people are shocked because it looked like he was about to close the deal. They're saddened. People go to watch the games live. They turn on the TV live to watch him. And beyond the sort of general disappointment, there are some journalists also asking, well, couldn't he have made perhaps more of a sacrifice? We are talking about salaries that are mind-bogglingly high. But, you know, he did offer, in his defense, to take a 50% cut, you know, and you can't begrudge a guy his well-earned six-figure, seven-figure income. So it's a mixed bag, but I would say overall, people just wish he'd stay. He's very well-liked. He's modest, as soccer players go, and he's just been a brilliant player.
What is next for Messi? You mentioned Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, it looks like they might be offering 40 million euros a year. It's a good chance he could end up there. I mean, who knows? The story changes every single day. At some level, it wouldn't be the worst change for us because he'd be back playing with Neymar. And, you know, Neymar played with Barca for a few years not too long ago with Luis Suarez. And those three up front were just amazing to watch together. So if he's back with Neymar, there could be a lot of magic there.
Reporter Jerry Haddon speaking with us about Lionel Messi, the international soccer star leaving his longtime club, FC Barcelona. Jerry, sad for you. Thanks for speaking with us, though.
A pleasure, Marco. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back. You're with the world. In England, a new report looks at the link between dementia and taking headers in soccer. For the son of one former star, the evidence is clear.
I think he will have headed the ball in training over 70,000 times. So for me, playing the game he loved killed him.
To change the rules of the game or not when health is at risk. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Earth is warming faster than ever, sea levels are rising rapidly, and the global community is nowhere close to meeting its targets to get things in check. Those are the headlines of a stark new report published by the UN today. Human-driven climate change is creating conditions we have not seen for thousands of years. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins me now. We talk climate reports a lot on the show, Carolyn. What's different about this one?
Margo, this report highlights that climate change is not a distant threat. It is something that is happening right now. Think those fires and floods and droughts and heat waves that we've been talking so much about. This report was produced by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the gold standard of climate science going back three decades. And for the first time in history, this body really connected the dots between climate change and specific extreme weather events. It says that heat waves, droughts, wildfires, and heavy rains have gotten more intense and frequent due to climate change. Hurricanes have gotten more intense, and human influence has likely increased the frequency of concurrent impacts, everything happening at once. This is all at about 1.1 degrees of warming Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit.
So the 2015 Paris Agreement set a target of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. This report finds that we're going to overshoot that by the early 2030s. So does that mean that missing the 1.5 degree target is tantamount to game over? I mean, is that like throwing the towel time?
It does not. This was one of the major findings from this report. They made some news by saying that we're going to hit 1.5 degrees by the early 2030s. But the report also found that if every country in the world really starts cutting emissions fast and drastically, then there is a possibility that levels of warming could come back down below 1.5 degrees by the end of the century. So it is not unattainable. But one of the report's authors, Bill Collins from the University of Reading, told me we just have to act really fast.
We can't wait for the next report. So by the time of the next report, it's too late. So this is the key information that governments need to act on.
And one more thing here, Marco, limiting warming to a degree and a half Celsius will bring us fewer catastrophic impacts, fewer deaths than limiting it to 2 degrees. 2 degrees is better than 2.5 or 3. So there's no singular red line here. And this report actually spells out what these differences are, what they look like in different regions around the world with these incremental increases.
I mean, we're already confronting ugly, deadly scenarios from floods to fires. Does the report offer examples about worse conditions?
Yes. So, for example, the kinds of deadly heat waves that, you know, a particular region might have gotten once every 10 years, by now we're already seeing them 3 times every 10 years. At a degree and a half of warming, that would raise up to 4 times every 10 years. And at 2 degrees of warming, it would be almost 6. So we're talking extreme heat, deaths, everything that's associated with that. A similar trajectory exists for heavy rains that cause flooding and drought. And if you think about sea level rise, right now sea levels globally have risen on average about 0.5 foot due to climate change. But whether they rise up to 1 foot or 6 feet by the end of the century is totally up to us.
So when we talk about these climate impacts and what action can actually do, how much of it is locked in and how much can we still actually change?
Well, temperatures are going to keep rising for decades no matter what because of all the carbon dioxide that we've pumped into the atmosphere already. These temperatures will stop rising, though, eventually if we stop emitting greenhouse gases. But there are other changes that will take much longer to reverse themselves, centuries or even thousands of years, including spikes in ocean temperature, sea level rise, and things like glacial melt.
You mentioned earlier the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and how they're the gold standard when it comes to climate science. Why is that?
Well, this is a comprehensive study. It's not just one group of scientists looking at one climate phenomena. It is 267 volunteer scientists from all over the world spending years looking at 14,000 published studies. Now, that means they have this really wide-ranging assessment of the current state of climate science. But there are also limitations to this method. For example, the most recent published studies that are included in their big analysis are 6 months old at this point.
It always seems like these reports are playing catch-up with the facts on the ground.
This is what Michael Mann, a well-known climate scientist at Penn State University, told me today. He says the IPCC's findings are also considered rather conservative. One reason for that is that climate models might not be capturing just how much the climate change is impacting things like the behavior of the jet stream.
These reports really are, by their construction, conservative. And that's important to understand because uncertainty is sometimes cited as a supposed reason for inaction. If anything, it's a reason for more concerted action.
And Carolyn, I imagine that's something the authors of this IPCC report do agree on, that inaction is certainly not the answer.
Absolutely. That is the message that these scientists are really trying to deliver to policymakers now. There is still time to act, but the window of opportunity is getting narrower and narrower and narrower.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Even if you're a casual football or hockey fan, you've probably noticed something different in the past few years. New rules to limit head contact. It's part of a big push to minimize the risk of brain injuries in sports. Now a leading expert in the United Kingdom is recommending that professional soccer make some big changes. As the world's Orla Barry reports from London, not everyone is on board.
Back in June, England fans experienced one of those moments at the European Football Championships that they'll never forget.
In comes the captain! 2-0 England! Harry Kane's championship has begun!
It was England versus Germany, and that goal, a header by team captain Harry Kane, helped secure England's place in the quarterfinals. Watching goals like this is bittersweet for John Stiles. His father, Nobby, was part of the last England team to win an international football tournament. That was the World Cup in 1966.
It's there! Peters has scored! For the Wembley thousands and the millions at home, one thought victory.
Afterwards, Nobby Styles famously danced a jig on the side of the pitch, holding the World Cup trophy in one hand, his false teeth in the other. Last October, Styles died with advanced dementia. His son John spoke with me on the phone.
He was aware he was losing his memory. Thankfully, in his last years, he wasn't aware of how poorly he was. It was just very, very sad.
Nobby Styles began to develop symptoms of dementia when he turned 60. John is convinced that practicing headers every day in training was what caused the brain damage.
I worked it out conservatively. I think he will have headed the ball in training over 70,000 times. So for me, playing the game he loved killed him.
It's not just a hunch that has John Styles blaming football for his dad's death. After he passed away, John donated his father's brain to science. The results showed Nobby Styles suffered from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. It's a neurodegenerative disease that's linked to repeated blows to the head, most often seen in professional boxers. And Nobby Styles isn't the only one from that England team to have had brain disease. In fact, out of the 11 players on the pitch that day, 5 developed dementia, and 4 of those men have already died from it. Neuropathologist Willie Stewart is with the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow. He says none of this is a coincidence.
A couple of years ago, we showed that for footballers, for soccer players, the risk of death with degenerative brain disease was considerably higher, 3.5 times higher than we'd expect. So you're 3.5 times more likely to develop dementia as a professional footballer as you were in the population.
Stewart decided to investigate further. In his latest study just released, he had more bad news for professional footballers. He found that the longer your career is, the greater the risk of brain disease. And for players who head the ball a lot, like defenders, the risk of dementia is far higher. The research was funded by England's Football Association, and the group appears to be rattled. A few days ago, it issued new guidelines, recommending that players should only carry out 10 so-called high-impact headers in 1 week's training. Willie Stewart says he's not impressed.
Unfortunately, that's based on pseudoscientific analysis with figures plucked from the air. You know, nobody's going to be policing this. Nobody's going to be enforcing this. It's just words.
I contacted the FA for comment, but it said no one was available for an interview. Stewart says the only safe solution here is to ban headers from football altogether.
When people say, you know, it's the end of the game, I think we need to look them in the eye and say, which would you rather? We make this change to the game, or would you rather continue to see your heroes on the field developing dementia at a very high rate?
Some prominent voices say more evidence is needed. Vincent Guthabarsh is chief medical officer with FIFPro, the International Federation of Professional Footballers.
The conclusion that heading is the cause for this higher risk for long-term neurodegenerative disease is not valid based on this single study. And it's why we need more scientific information about that. It is a logical hypothesis, but we don't have this kind of evidence, you know.
Guthabarsh says banning headers in the English league doesn't make sense if international leagues don't follow suit. John Styles says he finds all of this pretty disheartening, and not only because of what happened with his father.
It is also a concern for me because I wasn't as good as my dad, but I was a professional footballer for 10 years. So watching that happen to my dad, and I speak to other ex-players who are a similar age to me, I'm 57, we're massively concerned. I spoke to an ex-Premier League champion a couple of weeks ago, and he said he was terrified.
Styles tells me he feels abandoned by the FA, and that he's not the only one.
The footballers are treated like cattle, and as soon as they're no use to the clubs, they don't see any point in trying to help them. I mean, how those people, how the people in authority can look at themselves in the mirror and think, I've let all these people head the ball, and they're going to get ill, like my dad did. I don't know how they can live with themselves, really.
Styles says a class action lawsuit could soon be in the works, and ultimately, professional football bodies will be forced to change their tune. But for many players, he says, it may already be too late. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Finally, today, after nearly a year and a half, the Canadian border is open again. In one direction, anyway. Vaccinated Americans can now cross into Canada without having to quarantine. For Canadians heading south, no crossing over. As Benjamin Payne reports from Washington State, the new rules are leading to long-awaited reunions today, with some families still divided.
Justin Moat has yet to meet his 6-month-old nephew in person, even though he's really wanted to, and lives nearby.
So close. I mean, we're talking 30-minute, 45-minute drive to meet family. This kid's my blood, and I've never even laid eyes on him other than a photograph.
Moat lives in Bellingham, Washington, while his sister and nephew live in Tawasin, British Columbia. Normally, that border divide wouldn't be a problem. But the border shut down to non-essential travel in March of last year when the U.S. and Canada imposed restrictions on each other because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, an announcement from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau last month was welcome news to Moat and his family.
On August 9th, we will be opening non-essential travel to Americans who've been fully vaccinated for at least 14 days. This is in recognition of our unique bond, especially between border communities.
But not all border communities are rejoicing. That's in part because the U.S. isn't reciprocating, at least not at the land border. If a Canadian wants to visit the U.S., they can only fly, not drive. That's frustrating to Elizabeth Schweitzer. She's a teacher living in the U.S. just outside Buffalo, New York, while her fiancé, Paul Pollock, is a PhD student in nearby Hamilton, Ontario.
You know, Paul could fly here, but he'd have to go through like 3 airports and spend a few hundred dollars. And how is that safer than him getting in his car and making a 45-minute trip by himself as a fully vaccinated Canadian? Like, I don't understand.
When the U.S. Department of Homeland Security ordered its latest land border shutdown, Department Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas gave no evidence or argument as to why driving across the border would pose a greater risk of transmitting the virus than flying. Schweitzer and her fiancé aren't alone in their frustration with the mismatch in border policies between the U.S. and Canada.
It's typical with the way the two governments have behaved throughout the pandemic, which is that their border policies have been wholly uncoordinated.
That's Edward Alden, a professor of U.S.-Canada relations at Western Washington University.
You've created this legacy in which a crisis is an excuse to close the borders. And in the past, I think there was a very determined effort, you know, given the importance of the Canada-U.S. relationship, to try to really make that a last option.
Even though Canada is once again accessible to Americans, Alden warns that the country could rescind its reopening at a moment's notice, especially given the recent rise of the Delta variant. So, at least while he still can, Justin Moat is planning to hit the road north this week, even as his sister can't drive south. He's a bit concerned he might be treated harshly by Canadians he encounters along the border who are opposed to the reopening, but that's not going to stop Moat from seeing his new nephew.
If the border wants to give me crap, I'll take it because, you know, I do anything for family.
As for travelers from outside the U.S. looking to visit Canada, the border isn't scheduled to open until September 7th. For The World, I'm Benjamin Payne in Bellingham, Washington.
Now let's hear from somebody who did make it into Canada. American Kaya Williams was one of the first today. She drove up from Boston and is now north of the border, making her way with her mother, who's driving, to Nova Scotia for their annual family vacation. Kaya, where were you in line? One of the first people to cross the border this morning?
I think definitely not one of the first. We actually met quite a number of people on the road on the U.S. side of the border who were planning on crossing at 12:01 a.m. I have a feeling we were quite far behind in the numbers, but there wasn't a long line. There were only 2 cars in front of us when we went this morning.
Wow. So, I mean, you must have gotten up there pretty early. How'd you do that?
Well, when we heard the news that the border was opening, we booked a motel room probably about 2 hours after Trudeau made the announcement. We booked a hotel room.
So like right up on the border?
Yeah, right. Just about a mile from the border for last night.
Very good plan.
My mom flew into Bangor, Maine. I picked her up on the way. We spent the night, got up first thing this morning, and crossed the border.
All to get up to Nova Scotia for your family vacation. So I know you spent most of your summers in Cape Breton. I know it's a special
yes.
place. What did it mean to miss it last year?
I think this is the longest I've ever gone in my life without going up to Cape Breton. This feels more like my family home than anywhere else. Everyone in my family, I think, has just been feeling very homesick.
So now that you're in Canada, how does it feel?
Like a great relief. I think we were super nervous about whether, you know, we had to get all of our vaccination records in order and make sure that we had COVID tests that were negative and recent enough. And, you know, with the driving time, just making sure that we had everything set to go before we actually got in the car felt a little stressful. So now that we're across the border, I think we're both feeling very relieved and starting, still not quite believing that we made it. When we actually pull up to our house, we'll believe it.
So I gather you've been looking for a Timmy's, and for those listeners not in the know, that would be a Tim Hortons, a Dunkin' Donuts of Canada. did you find one?
Oh, but that's the first thing we did when we crossed the border was stop at Tim Hortons, but it was too early in the morning for my favorite sweet drink, so we're going to have to make a second stop to get an ice cap.
And a third, and a fourth.
And exactly. That's how you do it.
Kaya Williams is American. She's finally in Canada. Thank you very much for speaking with us, and enjoy the rest of your journey and vacation.
Of course. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Back to the latest climate report from the UN. As we reported earlier, the outlook is bleak. At the same time, as the Brits say, we got to keep calm and carry on, but also not repeat our mistakes. So how do we face that reality and still put one foot in front of another? And what does one generation owe the coming ones? Daniel Sherrell asks those questions in his new book, Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of the World. Let me just start, Daniel, with your reaction to today's news. When you saw the headlines this morning about the UN climate report and fires raging around the world, what were you feeling?
First, it's just, again, waking up in the morning, seeing that headline, just being saddled with the immense gravity of the crisis we're facing and allowing myself to like sit in that fear and grief. And it's immense. It's a difficult reality to assimilate how dire our situation is.
I imagine you feel that every time one of these kind of reports comes out.
I do, but I also feel an immense sense of the moral stakes that still exist. I mean, this report makes very clear that the difference for each tenth of a degree, we lower the temperature that our planet is overheating. We save millions of lives, literally millions of lives. So the reason that I do this work is that there really is still a wide swath of outcomes. There are levels of warming that we could get to. We're literally facing the collapse of civilization as we know it. So, yeah, it's a heavy feeling. I mean, I try to allow myself to sit with that,
yeah,
but also not to let it crush me.
I mean, those stakes that you just kind of outlined are why you wrote this book, Warmth, kind of getting the moral strength, taking on the challenge. You write that you grew up in a leafy suburban town, your parents at Rutgers University, your dad is a climate scientist. You write about how he was in Greenland drilling into the ice cap when your mother was pregnant with you. So the climate emergency has always been around front and center in your family, and yet it wasn't front and center. How do you see your parents' generation understanding of what you call the problem?
I think my parents' generation, who I have a lot of love for, I have many people dear to my heart who are boomers, I think they have a very hard time assimilating the full reality of the climate crisis. Because their schemas, the schemas through which they see the world, what the world is and how it works, were formed in decades where climate change was just not on anybody's mind. You know, and it makes sense to me that as you get older in life, your schemas through which you approach the world are both more costly to give up and more difficult to change. And this is not everyone. And I'm not even necessarily blaming people, but there does seem to be this sense of sleepwalking. And even with my own father, who's an oceanographer who studied global warming as it affected the Antarctic Peninsula in the 1990s, there was a sense that like he brought that information back. And we just living in the 90s in suburbia, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't know how to assimilate that. Contrast that with Gen Z, it's a generation below mine, who this is the water they've been swimming in since they came into political consciousness.
Well, there's a conversation you had with your father. Your father remembers it. You were 8 years old at the time. It's a talk you don't remember having with him, though. Can you tell us about that?
The way he tells the story, we were watching some nature documentary, I think, on television, and it mentioned something about global warming. And, you know, I asked him what that was, and he sort of sagely explained. And I was sort of apoplectic. I was like, wait a second. If what you're telling me is true, why haven't I heard about this before? Why isn't everybody talking about this constantly? Mm. And why haven't you told me about this already? Because I was eight, but I was like, I could have been doing something about this. You know, he says that conversation happened. I was very young. I don't have a memory of it. Maybe it's something that he subconsciously invented in retrospect to feel like we had gotten into it together. But even if it happened, I had nowhere to bring that strand. It wasn't until I got to college and met some amazing fellow students who had already been radicalized around the climate crisis that I was able to kind of situate and build on my values here and not feel so alone in them. And I think that is just so crucial for human life in the 21st century, is going to be processing this thing, not alone in our bedrooms on Twitter, but like together with each other over the dinner table, physically and emotionally holding each other.
So if Gen Z has been swimming in climate change in these deep pools of sorrow, as you say, and the boomers maybe not so dialed in as you would like them to be, how's the tragedy so different for your generation?
I was born in 1990. That was the year of the first big climate conference in Rio. And it's sort of like our coming of age has directly tracked the emergence of the climate crisis into public consciousness. But it's also been a kind of emotional whiplash for us to sort of come of age on the premise that, like, okay, welcome to the world. You get to be an architect or a doctor, or like whatever it is, and your future is bright. And then, like, as we emerge out of high school into college, it's like, wait, is our future bright? And suddenly there are asterisks and question marks over everything we had planned for the future. And I think a lot of us are still trying to find avenues through which to process that and process that in a way that doesn't just drink the sedative of blind optimism, but also doesn't like deflate into despair, because I don't think despair is actually a rational response to the situation.
So once we sit with that reality, allow it to fully settle in and see kind of what the future demands of us, what then do you want to convey to the next generation and those of us trying to cope psychologically with this grim reality that hangs over us?
I just want people to feel okay if they're feeling grief or confusion or overwhelm. Like, those are deeply rational responses to the dire situation we're in. But I also want to convey to people that we don't have to suffer through these things alone, that we live in a massive social web that, if we build it, can establish links of emotional solidarity and political solidarity that can actually be our saving grace in this century of upheaval. So, you know, I think a lot of my friends in and out of the climate movement describe feeling very alone in their feelings of overwhelm at the climate crisis, not knowing where to take them. And this book was an attempt to give people a place to take them and to start having the difficult conversations we'll need to have with our loved ones about what the next century is going to look like.
Daniel Sherrell's new book is called Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of Our World. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
The ska and reggae songbook has been filled with some curious cover songs over the years. A ska version of the big Hollywood opening to the 1960 film Exodus, or a Jamaican riff put on Dave Brubeck's jazz classic Take Five. But when you think about French composer Maurice Ravel's Bolero being recorded at Bob Marley's legendary Tuff Gong Studios in Kingston, the mind kind of reels. And yet, this is what 9 Jamaican musicians at Tuff Gong came up with. It works great. Would Maurice Ravel have appreciated it? Ravel himself was unhappy that of all his compositions, it was a simple melody of Bolero that got the most attention. A Jamaican version could be so far from the original that he just might warm up to it as much as we do. Kingston Bolero was recorded in Jamaica this summer, and it's just been released. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back with you tomorrow.